Listen to the best of the Church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
I'm a Christian. And I pray to Jesus Christ our Savior. And I've been doing it for many, many years.
President Obama spoke frequently about his Christian faith during his 8 years in office, frequently and openly. Yet some questions remain after those 8 years in the White House. When he was running for president, at first he said he was not a promoter of same-sex marriage. Later, he became a promoter of same-sex marriage, his so-called evolution on that subject. He pursued an HHS mandate that many interpreted as an attack on the religious freedom of many religious groups. And again, at first, he sounded very reasonable and open to new ideas on the subject of abortion, and yet later proved what, well, some people have said, the most pro-abortion president in U.S. history. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning in live this Wednesday afternoon, the 8th of February. We're going to be getting an inside look at faith and politics in the Obama White House with Michael Ware here in the better part of this hour. A little bit later, we're going to talk about the discovery, and this is just breaking news, the discovery of a 12th Dead Sea Scroll cave. There may not be any scrolls in it, but there's evidence that there were scrolls there. Dr. Craig Evans, author of Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence, will be our guest. Joining us to talk about an inside look at faith and politics in the Obama White House, Michael Ware, founder of Public Square Strategies. He served in the White House's faith-based initiative during President Obama's first term as director of faith outreach for President Obama's 2012 reelection campaign. And he's authored the new book, Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House about the future of faith in America. Michael, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, it's good to be on with you.
How did you first meet President Obama? What made you interested in working with him?
Yeah, well, I was interested in working with him. I had heard him give his 2004 convention speech where he spoke of the awesome God we serve in the blue states, and he gave a speech on faith and public life in 2006 where he, unusually for a Democrat, he advanced a view of a positive role that faith could play in our politics. And as a young Christian, that sounded about right to me. I met him. It's kind of an interesting story. I was supposed to be leading a group to a political event here in D.C. at the Washington Hilton Hotel. The problem is that I had the wrong date for the convention, and so I show up at this hotel and am kind of looking around for this meeting, and only come to learn that I had the wrong date. That was a couple days early, and as I'm leaving the hotel, Barack Obama, then Senator Obama, was walking into the hotel for meetings the day or two before the convention. I met him, told him I wanted to work for him, and 10 months later, I was in Iowa for his first presidential campaign.
How do you respond to someone who wonders how a Christian like you could work with a president who is pro-choice, has come to be supportive of gay marriage, and some view as anti-religious liberty?
Yeah, well, so I when I started working for then-Senator Obama, I disagreed with him on some issues, including life. I agreed with him on some significant issues as well, including immigration reform and international development and fighting poverty and health care. What's important to understand is that as Christians, we're always going to, we're never going to find the perfect political party. We're always going to be at tension with our political party, no matter where we are. My view of politics and what comes through in Reclaiming Hope in my book is that we're called to be faithful witnesses wherever we are. And so I worked for the president and was very clear about my views, was also clear about what my responsibility was working for him, but never lost sort of my Christian rootedness and the fact that my views didn't come from a political party platform, but came from scripture, came from my God.
How do you explain the tension in President Obama's frequent outward profession of Christianity and yet holding to unscriptural views on issues like abortion and homosexuality?
Well, I think that the president has a view of his obligations as president, of what is called for in a public leadership role. I write a chapter on his quote-unquote evolution on gay marriage, where I'm pretty clear about the fact that he ran in the 2008 campaign advancing one view and switched his position prior to the reelect, and what David Axelrod said was not really a switch at all. And I disagree with his theological views on the subject, but it's important not to sort of mistake political views as dogma or as sort of the same thing as holding to scriptural views. I think people understand it's a little more complicated than that.
At what point does a baby get human rights, in your view?
Well, you know, I think that whether you're looking at it from a theological perspective or a scientific perspective, answering that question with specificity, is above my pay grade.
So the fact is, after decades of progress, there's still those who want to turn back the clock to policies more suited to the 1950s than the 21st century. And they've been involved in an orchestrated and historic effort to roll back basic rights when it comes to women's health. And folks are trying to do this all across the country. When you read about some of these laws, you want to check the calendar. You want to make sure you're still living in 2013.
That's President Obama speaking at the Saddleback Forum in 2008 and then at a Planned Parenthood event in 2013. I listened to him at the Saddleback event, and I think to myself as a pro-lifer, here's a president I might be able to work with. And then I hear him 5 years later talking to Planned Parenthood and describing the efforts of the pro-lifers as turning back the clock. How do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, well, so I have a chapter in Reclaiming Hope about the failed attempt to find common ground on the issue of abortion. And it's true, when he entered office only months into his time as president, at the height of his political capital, he went to Notre Dame and called for reducing the number of women seeking abortions. And I was part of a policy effort to look at ways to do just that in partnership with the pro-life community. I tell the full story in my book, but for reasons of both policy and politics, that effort didn't get rolled out in the way that, you know, was thought possible during the president's first year in office. What I will say, and what I think pro-life Americans have to wrestle with, is the fact that at the end of his time in office, the abortion rate fell to its lowest since Roe v. Wade. So in 40 years under President Obama, the abortion rate is the lowest it has ever been in this country. And that's something that pro-life Americans should celebrate and encourage and want to see continue to drop. And so the president supported important policies that I think could be hailed as pro-life victories, such as getting the adoption tax credit made permanent, fighting pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. On the other hand, of course, he ran in 2008 as saying that he was open to all kinds of restrictions on abortion, and yet his administration never put forward any restriction on abortion of its own, and that's something that they should be held accountable for, too.
Some have called President Obama the most pro-abortion president in U.S. history, vocal about it. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, well, it's important. You know, they were saying that before he ever became president. And so that's one of the things I discuss in Reclaiming Hope, which is it was very hard for pro-life groups to try and defeat him in his 2008 campaign by saying he was going to be the most pro-abortion president and then sort of come find common ground with him. And so a major reason why the common ground effort didn't move forward was because pro-life advocacy groups here in D.C. didn't want to give give him the ability to say that he found common ground on this issue, didn't want to give him the ability to say that he had helped to heal the divide on this. And so what we need to think about how much electoral politics and sort of partisan gain is actually interfering with our ability to make progress on reducing abortion.
In your experience with President Obama, do you think he understands that many pro-lifers view themselves like the abolitionist movement, representing a segment of the population that really has no voice, that is the unborn?
I do think he understands that perception, and I think that that's clear in the way that he ran for president, which if you compare the way that he talked about an issue like abortion in that clip you aired with Rick Warren at Saddleback to how Hillary Clinton ran her campaign in 2016, the difference is pretty stark. And so he's been very clear that he's pro-choice. When I worked for him, I never communicated anything other than that because that was his view. But he also put himself in rooms where he heard strong arguments from pro-life leaders and pro-life Americans, and so I don't think that the issue is that he didn't understand where pro-life Americans are coming from.
Do you think that the pro-life community, just speaking generally, may have missed an opportunity with President Obama?
I do. I think that there was an opportunity in those first couple of years to push the administration to make good on some of their commitments, and instead of taking his campaign commitment seriously, not even from the outset, before he even made the commitments again, they were saying that he was going to be the most pro-abortion president whatsoever. So imagine what would have happened if pro-life Americans would have said, you know what, we actually believed you when you said that you supported abortion restrictions, and so the ball is in your court. Put forward abortion restrictions that we can consider, which you said that you supported in principle, and we'll find a way to move those forward together. And instead, from the very beginning of his administration, there was a policy of sort of disbelief of any of those commitments. And I do think that there were opportunities for making more progress on upholding life and upholding human dignity had his feet been held to the fire a bit more.
Michael Ware is our guest. We're getting an inside look at faith and politics in the Obama White House. He's written the book, Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House, about the future of faith in America. He had mentioned the Clintons. We're going to talk about Safe, Legal, and Rare right after this.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Faith Lutheran Church and School in Plano, Texas preaches Christ crucified. Join us each Lord's Day to hear law and gospel preaching and receive the Lord's Supper. Our classical preschool through grade 12 Lutheran school is second to none. The school serves home educators, too, with online classes in the high school. We are located at 1701 East Park Boulevard in Plano, Texas. Reach us by phone at 972-423-7448 or on the web at www.flsplano.org.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Michael Ware is our guest. He's founder of Public Square Strategies and served in the White House both as faith-based initiative and during President Obama's 2012 re-election campaign as faith outreach director. Michael, before the break, you had mentioned the Clintons, and I think they probably made common that phrase regarding abortion, safe, legal, and rare. What happened to rare?
Right. Well, that's a very good question, and we may be, it's possible that we would have a different president today had Hillary run a campaign that was consistent with the way that she'd talked about this issue in Arkansas and in the 90s and even in her 2008 campaign. Instead, you had a Democratic Party which for the first time in its history put repealing the Hyde Amendment and so support of federal funds for abortion as part of its platform. Part of the reason for that is that politics on both sides of the aisle has become much more about turning out their base, their core of support, instead of reaching out to Americans in the middle. And so in 2012, Democrats were able to win an election by focusing a bit more on their base. In 2016, they tried to double down on that model, and it didn't work. It didn't work in the Rust Belt, and it didn't work in for congressional elections either. And I think we're Democrats have to really reflect on whether that is the most productive way to move forward their agenda.
How do you explain the pro-life Democrat becoming something of an extinct species, the vanishing pro-life Democrat?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to what I just discussed. As ideological consolidation happens in both parties and as the influence of all kinds of special interest groups grow, there has been less room. Now, this is very different. In 2006, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee purposefully recruited pro-life Democrats. Previous Democratic Party platforms explicitly invited pro-life Americans to the party. And again, because of ideological consolidation, because of sort of the idea that it would be a compromise or sort of a betrayal to even make room for pro-life Democrats in the party, we've seen many of them get weeded out. Now, there are still pro-life Democrats in the party in office. There are pro-life Democrats. There are Democrats that rejected the party's call for repeal of the Hyde Amendment, but they're definitely not. There are definitely not as many as there were even a decade ago.
I am not somebody who promotes same-sex marriage, but I do believe in civil unions. I do believe that we should not that for a gay partners to want to visit each other in a hospital, mm-hmm. for the state to say, you know what, that's all right. Mm-hmm. I don't think in any way inhibits my core beliefs about what marriage are.
I vowed to keep up the fight against the so-called Defense of Marriage Act. There's a bill to repeal this discriminatory law in Congress, and I want to see that passed. But until we reach that day, my administration is no longer defending DOMA in the courts. I believe the law runs counter to the Constitution, and it's time for it to end once and for all. It should join Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the history books.
Michael, again, there we hear President Obama in 2008 speaking at the Saddleback Forum with Rick Warren on the issue of same-sex marriage, and then a different tenor later speaking, I believe, to Human Rights Campaign. What are your thoughts?
Well, right, and so it's, yes, he said that at Saddleback. That's important to be clear. In 2008, he wasn't sending different messages. On MTV, on the Sunday, I think the Sunday, the weekend before the election, he was telling the audience at MTV his position in support of historic or traditional marriage. And so the change has been over time, not depending on which audience he's been talking to. And so, again, I spend an entire chapter in my book walking the reader through exactly what that change entailed, what motivated it, what made it possible, and really facing with clear eyes some of the questions that it raises.
Give us a few reasons for his evolution on that issue from his first campaign to the end of his administration.
Well, I think it became politically possible to do so. The reasons that he gave is as he got more experience and spent more time and hearing from LGBT Americans, he became convinced that civil unions were not enough, and I think he viewed it as a possibility. Now, again, so in 2014, David Axelrod, his chief advisor, wrote a book saying that actually his stated position in 2008 wasn't really his position, that he supported same-sex marriage in principle the whole time, and that raises pretty significant civic questions.
You talk about it being kind of based in a deep cynicism. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean it was based in a deep cynicism. he ran, if it's true, it has not been rejected by the president or the White House since David Axelrod's book came out. Then, if it's true, then it was a instance of rejecting the very kind of politics that he campaigned on as possible in 2008.
Do you understand why many social conservatives found themselves frustrated with President Obama? They would hear him speak and he would sound very reasonable and very open-minded, and then later hear him talk in very stark terms about something like DOMA, and wonder if he's, well, bipolar on issues like this.
Well, you know, I don't know about that. I mean, I will say, you know, there is much more on the minds of even conservative Christians in this country than the issues we've discussed so far in this interview. And as we've seen, they aren't necessarily holding Donald Trump's feet to the fire on this issue either. And so, you know, I spend a whole chapter on these issues in my book, but I think the president, he was very clear that he opposed DOMA from the beginning. He was very clear that he supported things like hospital visitation early on. One of the aims of Reclaiming Hope is to help readers both on the right and the left have a more clear-eyed understanding of even those they disagreed with and what was real and what was kind of played up for politics. And so I spent time just discussing just how vapid the war on women, war on religion dichotomy was that really evaded some of the core policy questions at play.
You tell the story of the HHS mandate, really in the end, how it came to mark the end of his presidency with respect to religious liberty. How can you explain the HHS contraception mandate, Little Sisters of the Poor?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it marked the end of his presidency on religious liberty during and after the contraception mandate. He was defending the National Day of Prayer in court. His administration was winning Supreme Court cases that defended religious freedom, such as the Abercrombie case. What I write in the book is that the contraception mandate was certainly a turning point in his relationship with the religious community, particularly with religious conservatives. The central question of the mandate was, after the Institute of Medicine's decided that contraception should be included as a preventive service, how the preventive service provision in the Affordable Care Act then put the burden on employers to cover all of those preventive services, things like mammograms, things like vaccines. Well, now that contraception was included, for many religious employers in particular, it carried a different moral weight. And so the position that the issue that the administration had to deal with was, do you carve out an exception for religious organizations, and how broad should that exception be? And you have to weigh that against how many Americans will then have their coverage exempted from having preventive services or having access to contraception. And so I talk about religious freedom as not coming under direct attack. What we're seeing increasingly in this country is that religious freedom is under pressure, that it's becoming, in some cases, collateral damage in pursuit of other government aims. And if we talk about these issues as though folks are waking up in the morning thinking, how do I harm religious freedom today, then we're not really dealing with reality. We're not dealing with what is the actual claim being made.
Why did President Obama frequently use the term freedom of worship instead of freedom of religion or free exercise of religion?
Yeah, that's not, I've heard that claim. Judd Birdsall wrote pretty extensively in Christianity Today, refuting that claim. Throughout our history, freedom of worship has been used interchangeably. I've worked with the president on speeches where he talked extensively about freedom of religion as the free exercise. And so that's one of those claims that isn't necessarily rooted in reality of how the administration thought about religious freedom claims.
In that vein, in 2012, some claimed that Louis Giglio was pressured to withdraw from giving the inaugural benediction. What do you have to say on that?
Yep, so that is, again, I write a chapter on that, and it was really a very similar situation as in 2009, when Rick Warren was asked to give the invocation, and he received attacks for supporting Proposition 8. And in 2009, actually, the statement was made in late 2008. The president said, yes, Rick and I disagree on significant issues, but we live in a big, diverse country, and the inauguration is for everyone. In 2013, unfortunately, that same principle wasn't applied in the same way. Instead, inclusion seemed to be a reason to exclude someone like Louis. And if readers want to get to know more about that situation, and they could check out Reclaiming Hope.
Why was he pressured to withdraw?
Well, if you remember the scenario, a 20-year-old clip of a sermon Louis gave where he spoke about LGBT issues was brought to air by a liberal blog. Those comments were taken to be offensive by many, and pressure was built up for the president to distance himself and for the inaugural committee to distance themselves.
We're talking with Michael Ware, founder of Public Square Strategies, author of the new book, Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House About the Future of Faith in America. When we come back, it has been alleged that President Obama has connections to liberation theology. We'll see what he thinks about that after this.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with the new Martin Luther plush figure. It features the 16th century reformer holding the Bible and Luther's morning and evening prayers. Go to reformationgear.com, use the coupon code ISSUESETC, and 20% of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. ReformationGear.com, the new Martin Luther plush figure, ReformationGear.com, and enter the coupon code ISSUESETC.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as Confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the CLCC.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a confessional Lutheran. The CLCC.org.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 8th. We're getting an inside look at faith and politics in the Obama White House. Michael Ware is our guest. He served as the White House Faith-Based Initiative Director during President Obama's first term and Director of Faith Outreach for President Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. His new book is called Reclaiming Hope. Some have heard in President Obama's way of speaking about Christianity tones of a kind of liberation theology, basically a theology where Christianity, the kingdom of God, is to be established here through the lifting of oppression of disenfranchised or oppressed people or identity groups, instead of Christianity primarily being about the kingdom of God being brought by Christ, whose kingdom is not of this world, but culminated in his return and his resurrection. Do you hear that? And do you think that that fairly represents the president's view?
No, I don't. I don't think that that is reflected in if you take the president's comments on faith as a whole. I mean, I think the best way to look at how the president considers faith is by looking at his national prayer breakfast speeches, and people are welcome to read those online. I discuss them extensively in Reclaiming Hope. I think in general, we have an idolatry of politics in this country that has allowed religious leaders to claim that if their party gets elected, that that is going to be a way that is sort of installing the kingdom of God, but we've seen that with religious conservatives hailing the election of Donald Trump. And so I'd say to the extent that people viewed Barack Obama's election as the primary means of advancing God's kingdom, that is actually a reflection of a much broader problem, and one that in many ways originated, at least in its modern incarnation, in its modern form, with the religious right.
At the same time, the Obama's pastor for 20 years, as you know, Jeremiah Wright, is a pretty strong proponent of a form of a liberation theology. Is it fair to characterize President Obama as a proponent of it, given that association?
No. Some of these, the president has spoken for himself based on his faith. And so you could read the president talk for himself about his religious views and make a judgment on his national prayer breakfast speeches and the times when he's extensively talked about his views on religion. And in April of 2008, he was very clear about the fact that oftentimes that he didn't agree with Reverend Wright on everything, just as many Americans don't agree with their member of the clergy on everything. And so, no, I'm not going to pontificate on Reverend Wright, who the president hasn't been in church with Reverend Wright in a decade.
How do you explain Hillary Clinton getting only 16% of white evangelical votes?
Yeah, well, she didn't ask for them. And so that's a major factor. She seemed to ask for the votes directly of just about everybody except for them. Didn't show much concern for their policy views. Didn't speak to their concerns around religious freedom. And so that didn't help. White evangelicals have to ask themselves why their priorities were so different from their Christian and brothers and sisters who are not white evangelicals. And that, to me, is a significant internal question for the white evangelical church to ask, which is, how much is your politics being about sort of self-preservation and about sort of tribalism as opposed to something that's more fully informed by your faith?
You've watched two Hillary Clinton campaign's been involved running against her once. Was the Clinton campaign this time tone deaf to many white Catholics?
Yes, and tone deaf only to the extent that they actually heard them at all. I mean, right? So it's now infamous that, you know, the campaign didn't step a foot in Wisconsin, assume that the Rust Belt was theirs when, and it reported in the New York Times 2 days after the election, her campaign asked her to go to her supporters in South Bend, Indiana, home of the Fightin' Irish, asked her campaign to send Clinton to a St. Patrick's Day event, and the campaign basically responded that white Catholics weren't a priority for them this time around, and that's like 19% of the electorate, and you could point directly to Catholics as a major reason why she did not win in those Rust Belt states. It's a significant problem. She was the first Democrat to lose the Catholic vote since 2004 in John Kerry. Barack Obama in both 2008 and 2012 won the Catholic vote.
You say that there is a religious illiteracy problem in the Democratic Party. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's coming along in the Republican Party as well. It's just trailing behind for demographic and other political reasons. America is becoming more religiously illiterate, more secular. Church attendance is down. Religious disaffiliation is up. And in the Democratic Party is now a third religiously unaffiliated or non-Christian, and the non-Christian slice is really small compared to the religiously unaffiliated piece. And so, you know, it, just from a political perspective, we're still a country that is 70% plus religious, but if your party leadership is full of, and your strategists are full of folks who don't understand religion as a motivating force in a large number of Americans' lives, not only is that going to harm you politically, but when you get into office, when you're actually representing them, you're going to be less equipped to do so. And so the Democrats really need to consider this to be a problem, just like they'd consider a literacy about any other constituency's issues would be a problem.
If you had the opportunity to speak to a group of conservative, evangelical, and Catholic leaders, how would you admonish them?
You know, I'm not too much for the admonishing. I'd say that now is not a time for withdrawal from politics, from public life. It is also not a time it is a time for faithfulness. It is a time to actually be explicit about the Christian hope that we carry. This is not a time for conciliation and for being quiet about what we disagree with, even among our friends. And so I don't know if it would be an admonishment, but actually an encouragement that now is actually precisely the time when many of our neighbors are asking significant questions. And instead of seeing that questioning as sort of a shove out of the public square, we ought to view the fact that so many major questions are up for grabs as an invitation into the public square.
On the other hand, if you had the opportunity to speak to a group of mainline liberal Protestant leaders, how would you advise them on what you perceive as weaknesses there?
Honestly, it would be the same thing, which is that whether it's conservative or liberal, I've seen it in D.C. for I think different reasons. But if you view that the ends justify the means, and if you view that if you sort of equivocate on Christian belief and Christian expression in order to advance political priority, we just have to be careful about that. Now, politics is complicated. We all sort of get it wrong at certain points, but it's really important that Christians have unique resources to contribute to our political debate. If our presence is not distinctive, then what are we here for anyways? If we're just going to engage in politics based on the same mode of self-interest and the same mode of maximizing sort of short-term political gain and worrying about the future when it comes, then what are we contributing other than being another voting bloc? And that would be my advice to Christians of all stripes and backgrounds.
As a Christian, of what accomplishments are you most proud while you were working in the White House?
Yeah, well, I'm proud that we made the adoption tax credit permanent. Adoption is very important to me. I'm proud of the fact that 20 million more Americans have health insurance. I believe the president stewarded this country through a pretty extensive economic crisis so that we ended up on firmer footing. I'm proud of the work that we did to combat human trafficking and the way that the president and the United States raised its profile on what I consider to be the civil rights issue of our time. And so those are just a few of the policies that I was able to have some role in playing in that I'm proud that we accomplished.
What did you learn about the future of faith in America during your time in the White House?
Yeah, quite a bit. I think that the primary thing I'd say is that now is the time to sink our roots deeper into faith. It's at times of political crisis and unsettlement that we can be motivated, that we think, maybe politics just isn't working out because we haven't staked enough of our identity in politics. And I think that's exactly the wrong approach. It is not safe to engage in politics with your feet planted in politics. It's actually when your feet are planted in the gospel that you're going to be most effective, most edifying to the public square and to political life in America. And so that has been something that I've expressed. And then I'd just say I focus on my book on two issues looking forward, and obviously could write about more, but I think the future of religious freedom and the future of issues of racial justice are going to be just critical to determining not just the future of our country, but the future of the American church. And so as a church, we need to be thinking carefully and thoughtfully and actively about how we're going to engage and be productive and be faithful in the areas of religious freedom and racial justice moving forward.
Finally then, Michael, what do you say to a Christian listening to us who's just completely cynical about American politics? It's a dirty business. I'm going to disengage from the political process, they say. What do you say to them?
I would tell them that when your hope is in the right place, when you're standing on the ground of real hope, then all kinds of new possibilities open up for you. And you're actually able to bring a new vision to what may seem like hopeless circumstances. And so I would urge folks to put their hope in Jesus and then carry that hope into being agents of restoration, agents of hope in not just politics, but in their communities and in their workplace and in all things public. And that will be a good direction for all of us to go.
Michael Ware is founder of Public Square Strategies. He served in the White House's faith-based initiative during President Obama's first term, director of faith outreach for President Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. He's author of the new book, Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House About the Future of Faith in America. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Michael, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate being out.
When we come back, Dr. Craig Evans will be our guest. We're going to talk about the discovery of a 12th Dead Sea Scroll cave that announced just hours ago. We'll be right back.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, invites you to an open house from 1 to 3 in the afternoon on Sunday, February the 12th. Take a tour, visit with faculty and administration, and find out more about financial assistance and scholarships. For more information, call Dr. Jay Krause, 618-656-0043, or send an email to j.krause@melhs.org. Open house at Metro East Lutheran High School, Edwardsville, Illinois, Sunday afternoon, February 12th.